Please join in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. The format of tonight's meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, the first of which will speak on the third tradition, followed by our information break. Then our main speaker, who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker to share on the third tradition is Stephen.
Hello, my name is Steve, and I'm an alcoholic. I believe I'm supposed to read the long form of the tradition. And just bear with me, I gotta find it here. I know where it is. Where? I have these pocket, I've always had the pocket big book. I don't know where anything is in this big one. Okay, here it is. Thank you. The third tradition. Our membership ought to include all who suffer from alcoholism. Hence, we may refuse none who wish to recover. Nor ought AA membership ever depend on money or conformity. Any 2 or 3 alcoholics gathered together for sobriety may call themselves an AA group, provided that, as a group, they have no other affiliation. Todd, thank you for asking me to speak tonight. You know, I'm not an AA historian, so there have been some really wonderful speakers here. I've been a member of this group for 6 years, and I've heard some fantastic traditions described here, and I'm not one of those people. I'm not a historian. I'm just a drunk who speaks from the heart. I could tell you my experience because that's really all I have. If you came here to hear the tradition in the form of history, AA history, how it applies to AA, there's some wonderful books like AA Comes of Age and As Bill Sees It, and I haven't read either of them. But I hear they're wonderful. I read this. This is called Alcoholics Anonymous. It's what we call our big book. I also read the 12 Steps and 12 Traditions. And it's funny that I was asked to speak on Sunday, this past Sunday, about the third tradition. And just last week, I was reading the third tradition with my sponsees up in the balcony before the meeting. And wow, I've never read the third tradition in the 12 and 12. And I found so much in there. We were all kind of blown away by it. You know, there's really two stories that are illustrated in there. One is the story of a man who they don't say his name. And what they say is that he appeared at a group's doorstep, and he conferred with one of the group's elders. And he said to them, I'm paraphrasing here, but he said to them, will you have me? Can I become a member of this group? And they said, well, of course. You know, you have this disease, alcoholism. He said, well, the problem is that I suffer from something even worse, even more unspeakable. I can only imagine what that might have been back then. It was, I believe in, well, the next story is a man named Ed, and that occurred in 1938. So it was about then, okay? And what's so interesting for me about that is I was that guy. When I came to AA, I didn't even know I was an alcoholic. And if somebody asked me, do you have a desire to stop drinking? I would have said, no. No. I do not have a desire to stop drinking. I don't have a desire to do any of the things that you're expecting me to do. My wife has a desire for me to stop drinking. Honestly, guys, that's why I came to AA. And I did not identify as an alcoholic. I had a major problem with another substance. Are you okay, Peggy? I think most of us these days have had a problem with another substance. And that's kind of what this tradition is about. Okay? We are not turned away because of that. My primary problem, I identify it today as alcoholism, but if you asked me that day when I walked into AA, it was not. I didn't even know what alcoholism was. I had no idea. Much less did I know. Two, maybe 3 years later, I didn't even know alcoholism looked like this. But it does. And thank God nobody turned me away. Thank God nobody said to me, no, you can't come here. They said, keep coming back. And that worked for me for about 6 months, and then I didn't want to come anymore because I wasn't working the steps, but that's another story. But the point here is, listen, newcomers, or people like me who have a little bit more time than a newcomer, or people who have even more time and just aren't feeling it anymore, this is a place for us. This is a place for us, and nobody's going to tell you you don't belong here because you've done something else or you do something else or you enjoyed something else and that thing stopped working for you. Do you have a problem with alcohol? Has your life become unmanageable? Is it an issue? Can you control your drinking? No? Welcome. Welcome. Do not ever leave here if you wish to be happy. We have a solution that works for alcohol. I cannot tell you about other things. I can't tell you about overeating. I can't talk to you about gambling. I can't talk to you about crystal meth. I don't even know what that stuff looks like. But I can talk to you about alcohol. I can tell you what worked for me and what didn't work for me. And there are 600 other people here tonight who can do that too. And we're proud of that. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. We're very proud of that. I want to touch on something else here. Money or conformity? Money. You don't have to have money to be here. Sure. A dollar, $2, really $2 these days, helps keep this going. But if you don't have that, we're not going to tell you go away. We're not going to tell you you don't belong. You belong. You have a problem with alcohol? You belong. Money or not. And conformity. This is the Atlanta group. A lot of people have some strange notions about us. Conformity. I kind of smiled when I read that because I'm a member of this group and I know a lot about what's said and what's not and what people think and what they... You know what? I'm only dressed in a suit because that's what the group asked of me tonight. My sponsees don't have to come to all the Atlantic group meetings. They don't have to have an Atlantic group sponsor. They don't have to do anything. The only thing that they have to do is have an honest desire to stop drinking. Be willing to do what it takes. And, you know, that comes in varying degrees. We're all human. But they come back. They come, and they come, and they come, and they reach out. And if there's any one thing that I can say about conformity in this group is that we reach out. We do service. And that keeps us all sober. Another thing here is, it says, any two or three alcoholics gathered together for sobriety may call themselves an AA group, provided that as a group they have no other affiliations. That's very important. That keeps us pure. That keeps us AA. That keeps us from not being a hospital, you know, St. Luke's or the Rikers Island group or whatever. We're AA. This is where alcoholics come. This is what we do. We do Alcoholics Anonymous. We take sick people, spiritually, mentally, physically sick people, and we help them to get well. And we're proud of that. We love that. So, as an alcoholic, I'm happy. I'm happy to be here. When I first came in, I put my hand up. I said, I'm an addict. Well, all right. If that's what you want to do today, that's on you. That's fine. Stick around. You'll find out things about yourself. I promise you that. And stick around even further. Your whole world is going to change. Your whole life is going to change. It's remarkable what this program has to offer. Thank you very much for asking me to speak, Todd, and thank you, group, for what you've given me.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Bella.
Hi, everybody. My name is Bella, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you so much, Hannah, for asking me to speak. Thank you so much, Peggy, for finding this group and for the structure. So, my sobriety date is August 5th, 2011. I have a sponsor. My sponsor is a sponsor. I have a home group. I have two home groups, actually. I pray and meditate every day. When I say pray, I mean that I say, like, hey, power greater than myself, which is happening to be not me. Please keep me sober today. You know, I sit there quietly and just try to listen. You know, I have like three service commitments at the moment. And, you know, when I was drunk, I had like four service commitments to my dealers and to my clubs. So, you know, the first thing I would like, and also, you know, I have sponsee. It's not one sponsee. I'm always looking for more, but I've had many sponsees since I've finished the steps. Those sponsees kept me sober. Service keeps me sober. You know, why does the service keep me sober? Why does it say, you know, if you have to give it away to keep it? It's because, you know, every time I tell you how I stay sober, I really say that to myself, right? Otherwise, I'm going to forget, right? Because, like, for example, when I got really drunk, you know, and I would wake up in the morning with, like, cuts on my wrist and all that kind of stuff, right? It would be horrible, right? But by the end of that day, I'd forget all about that, you know, and I'd go to the bar again, like, no problem, right? So it's the same thing for me with sobriety, right? Like, if I don't tell you this, if I don't tell you how I stayed sober today, I'm going to forget how I stayed sober today, and I'm just going to drink tomorrow, you know, because obviously, you know, now I've been sober for 2.5 years, what a miracle, you know, and I forget. You know, if I don't hear you tell me how bad it is, I'm not going to remember. I'm going to remember, like, the glamour. Oh, you know, but he used to help me to do this. He used to help me to do that. You know, I'm going to forget this stuff. You know, it's just like a marriage. You know, you get divorced, and all of a sudden, oh, we used to have such a great time. You know, it's like rose-colored glasses, you know? So I'd like to tell you that I'm a relapser. I'm the queen of relapse. I'd like to say to, you know, the newcomers that are sitting here today, you know, and seeing all of us smiling, when I came here and I saw all of you smile, all of you wearing suits, you know, there were two things I thought, like, cult and, like, I gotta get the hell out of here, you know? And I'd like you to know that, you know, I relapse more times than I can count. You know, there's people here that know me. There's people here that saw me fall down the stairs. There's people here that saw me snore on people's shoulders. There's people here that saw me do things that I don't remember that I do. And every time they tell me, I'm like, really? You know? Because, you know, I kept coming. And just like Steven said, you know, I kept drinking, but I kept coming. You know, I kept coming. Those three words saved my life. Keep coming back. You know, nobody in my family is an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic, right? But if I didn't keep coming back, I wouldn't have known that I'm an alcoholic. You know, like the fact that no one in my family is an alcoholic, I wasn't even associated. I mean, I was a bartender, but there was nobody close to me that, you know, I could say this person is an alcoholic or anything like that, you know? I didn't know that until this one day, this girl, after I got kicked out of Bellevue, and, you know, they made me come to AA, you know, and this girl said to me, and, you know, I came, and I had 40 days, and I'm like, you know, I just don't identify with your stories at all. I wish I did. And she told me, okay, no problem. She's like, why don't you go to a bar and just try to have two drinks, and that's it. And I was like, see you later, you know? That's when I realized I'm an alcoholic, okay? Because there was no way I can have those two drinks and stop drinking. That brought me to my knees. You know, I used to think that the other substances are my problem. But, you know, somehow I stopped those other substances. I couldn't stop drinking. You know, I got to the point where I was really desperate. Now, if I didn't keep coming back when I was really desperate, I would not be able to look up, you know, not even believing it, but I wouldn't even see it as an option to look up and say, you know, hey, you know, I can't stop drinking. You know, please take, if you're up there, you know, please take this choice away, you know, or I'm going to die. That would not be a consideration for me, you know, because you know, when I came here and I heard God and I heard our Father, you know, to me, that was like, oh, great. So now I lost everything, right? I'm in hell. And what's your solution? Well, there is God. Look up. Like, thanks. Thanks. Okay. Like, give me a job, you know? But, you know, I saw, because it kept coming back, you know, and I went to all kinds of meetings, you know. First, I wasn't ready for this group, you know. I wasn't ready for smiles, you know. I was ready for problems. I was ready to identify with problems, you know. It is when I realized that I have these problems that you have. It is when I realized that I'm an alcoholic, that I cannot stop drinking, you know. That one day when I got that gift, you know, when I realized I'm going to die, you know, and I realized that I can't do that to my family. That one day, you know, I had 5 sponsors. You know, I came in here and I heard someone say to, you know, not to this group, but I heard someone say, you know, meeting makers make it, right? So I was like, all right, you know, and I made meetings, you know, and I kept drinking, but I made meetings. You know, I heard someone say, you know, take what you want and leave the rest, right? So, you know, like, I had the sponsor, you know, but the sponsor, she's like, she's not my mother, you know. My mother died. I came here. My father died, you know. I came here, you know, I took care of myself. Now you're going to tell me what to do. Today I know, you know, after my 5 sponsors, you know, today I know that, no, she's not my mother, you know, but she's an alcoholic just like me, and obviously it works for her because she's smiling, you know. One day I woke up and I was like, you know, all these people that are smiling, wow, you know, I want to smile, you know. And then I realized that day that in order to smile, in order to stop drinking, for me personally, okay, I have to do everything, okay? This is what half measures avails us nothing means. When I tried to do some things and not others, I kept drinking. It's really simple for me, you know? I needed the kind of place where they're going to tell me 24 hours what to do. And it's just alcohol dictated me 24 hours, like, believe me, it was always alcohol. Alcohol was my higher power. Why was it my higher power? Because when I was scared, I went to alcohol, right? When I was angry, I went to alcohol. When I didn't know what to do, I went to alcohol, right? So now I have to find, like, something else, right? Because obviously that stopped working for me, right? That's why I'm here, right? I have to find something else, right? And, you know, it's like a marriage, right? Yes, so I did have that moment, and I did look up, and that choice was taken away from me, right? But if I meet some guy, and he does something really nice to me, I'm not going to marry him, right? I have to establish a relationship with him, right? I have to establish trust. I have to establish, you know, being able to share with him everything and know that he's not going to leave me, you know? Otherwise, you know, this guy just means something to me for the moment. And that's why I had to go through the steps. That's why I had to come here. You had to take me through the steps. And in order to get through those steps, I had to do everything. You know, because on step 4, I wanted to drink, drug, kill myself, and have like tons of sex, you know? And the fact that I prayed and meditated every day and did service and did what I was told, you know, I had what y'all wanted, you know? The steps helped me build a relationship with my higher power, you know? When I got through step 3 and I made a decision to go to you instead of to go to alcohol. When I got to step 4 and I went through all my resentments, you know, and you know, I was sexually abused. Both my parents died. I was raped. I was divorced. You know, that's not what makes me an alcoholic, right? Because I know a lot of incest survivors. I know a lot of people going through divorces and they're not spending their time at a bar. They maybe have other issues, right? But, you know, all of these things, right, that happened to me, you know, I forgot what I was going to say, but that's okay. But, you know, the point is that I had to establish a relationship. And in step 4, when I didn't drink from my resentments, and I didn't drink from my part, and in step 6 and 7, when I was able to admit, you know, these are my faults, you know, I'm this, I'm that, I'm the other, without drink, this is like a miracle. Like, I would drink over any one of those resentments. Like, I had to drink to go to the deli. Okay? And now I got through this step. Of course I'm going to trust some. I didn't get through this, right? So of course I'm going to have a bigger relationship with my higher power because I did not do this, right? So by the time I finished the 12 steps, when they say spiritual awakening, what it meant to me, okay, was that I don't need to drink, I don't need to do drugs, I don't need to eat, and I don't need to have really a lot of relations, right? In order to feel this relief, you know? And I was the kind of person that needed 24/7, you know? So again, you know, if you're a newcomer, you know, there's just one thing I have to tell you. You know, this is what I did, you know, just please, please keep coming back. I love you all so much. You saved my life. Thank you.
Our main speaker tonight is Laura.
My name's Laura C. I'm an alcoholic. Times like this, I like to remember that no one can tell my story but me, and that it's just as valuable as anyone else's story. If you're new and you don't relate to anything I say, please bear in mind that I'm not speaking on behalf of AA. I'm speaking on behalf of myself. So what you'll hear is a little bit of my own experience, strength, and hope. It may or may not relate to anyone else here. I want to thank Todd for asking me to speak and publicly forgive him for suggesting I wear a dress. And with that in mind, I just want to say that I believe that the unspeakable third tradition addiction was to man flesh. So on behalf of all us gays, when it comes to the third tradition, you're welcome. So my sobriety date is June 29th, 1995. I haven't found it necessary to drink or drug since I walked in here. So I know how to stay sober a day at a time, which I think is why Todd asked me to speak. In case you'd like to zone out after a couple minutes, I'll put the cliff notes up front. So the way it's worked for me, the ways I've stayed sober are to have a home group. My home group is the Greenwich Village Group. I have a sponsor and a sponsee. My sponsor's name is Jane, and she tries to keep me on the straight and narrow, and we try to talk every day. My sponsee's name is Diane, and we work the steps together. Working the steps has been important to me, despite the fact that I'm an atheist, and even though I'm an atheist, I'm glad that Jesus is behind me tonight. The other thing that I've done to stay sober and do to stay sober every day is service. So, you know, my service commitment today is that I'm the program chair for my home group. For me personally, it's really important to do service at my home group. I'm doing service in a couple of other ways right now because it's been suggested by my AA friends and my sponsor that I have other things to bring to the table. So right now I'm the DCM for the West Village in Soho. If you go to a meeting down there, our district meeting is tomorrow at 7 at the LGBT Center. Please send a rep. I'm also the treasurer for Manhattan. So the ways that I've stayed sober a day at a time really consistently for over 18 years are that I've got a sponsor, and after I had worked the steps and had a year of sobriety, I got a sponsee. I've got a home group, and I do service there, and I work the steps. So those are the cliff notes. What I was told when I came in was to always talk about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And this is not, I don't think, the ideal setting to discuss my childhood, but it is the time for that. And I know that that is one part of my experience to which many of you will relate. Mine happened in Arkansas, which might be different. I'm sure it looked different, smelled different. I know it sounded different. But I'm sure that there are other people here who had two drunk parents and a drunk sibling and who grew up getting beaten every day, which was my story. I have a father who looks like me, smells like me, talks like me, drinks like I drank, took out his rage, and I think some flashbacks from Vietnam, on me specifically. Both my parents drank a lot, as I mentioned. My mother liked to talk a lot about how she was suicidal, and she was going to kill herself, and someday you're not going to have a mother anymore. And she also liked to disappear. Both my parents liked to disappear for weeks at a time. And that didn't start once we were able to take care of ourselves or when we had a babysitter. That's how I grew up. My folks kept a roof over our head, but they weren't real focused on things like kids grow out of clothes and still need new shoes. And they weren't real focused on making sure dinner was in the house. So we had a lot of really practical issues. My sister was 3.5 years younger than me, still is, I suppose. So I fell into a provider and teacher role really, really, really early. When I was eight, the other thing to know is that I grew up really fundamentalist Christian down south. My mom believed in sort of balance sheet spirituality. Like, she could have her little girlfriend in Memphis, which I think she's still with that woman when she's not with her husband. And she could, you know, she could drink a lot, pop a lot of pills, be suicidal. But as long as she did this other stuff, like church all the time, she made me wear a dress too, Todd. And, you know, as long as she balanced things out. So we were very religious, and a little boy that I went to school with, was a few years older than me, suggested when I was eight that if we delivered packages, we could make a little money. This was in Memphis, where my mother's lover was, and we would be sort of dropped off there often on weekends with no supervision. So I started delivering packages. I didn't know what packages were. I knew that I got money when I delivered the packages, and I knew that I must come back with the money, or no package, no money, no package. And I learned a few years later when I started seeing how these packages impacted people. And it took me a while to figure out that I was running drugs. And which was really, in Memphis, we use kids for that. And I was ideal because I was tall. My dad developed guns and ammunition for Remington Arms. And so I knew my way around a handgun. And but I was real white. So what happened was, if I got in trouble, they just picked me up and delivered me back home. So I'd be in these terrible neighborhoods, and you didn't really want to mess with me. So I was very successful in this field because I had a lot of the tools for it. And I told myself that I would never drink, because I had a lot of evidence that drinking was bad news, because I got beat worse when my dad was drunk, which was always. But I knew that it meant bad things for me. Drinking was bad, and I had, you know, all four of my grandparents were drunks, all my aunts and uncles, and so I knew that I should not drink. And I knew the risks of dry goods too. A lot of people died around and in front of me from a very young age. And eventually, I got a case of what I'll call in this meeting the forget-its. And that led to me picking up. You know, I was a kid. I was like 11 years old. I started doing everything at the same time and loved it, like loved it on a cellular level. When I got here, I didn't think anybody with double-digit sobriety was actually sober, because I didn't think you could be. Like, I didn't understand that someone could not drink who wanted to drink as much as I wanted to drink. So I drank as much as I could, as often as I could, which was pretty much every day, because we didn't have a lot of rules or supervision. We didn't have any. And I started having physical consequences really quickly. I used to shake off the bed at night, was sort of the first one. So what that meant is that I took the bed frame out of the room. And so I was still shaking at night and popping out of the bed and getting hurt. So I built up like a level of trash all around my room so that I would just sort of roll around on the trash. And I did, even though I was a kid, I still had the progression. When I look back on it, when I first came in, I thought about, you know, progression a lot and how it was a fatal chronic disease, physical, mental, spiritual. But when I look back on it now, my progression was so quick. And I didn't have a spiritual life. I mean, I was going to church three times a week. And I knew the Bible really well. I was a Bible I also like to blow things up, and I would win these Christian leadership trophies and explode them in my room. But I didn't have a, like, I don't think I was ever a believer. I always knew that I was queer. I always identified a little too male for that dress, and so I knew that God hated me, which made it less enticing to believe in God. So I didn't have a spiritual life to lose. Like, I didn't. So it's a physical, emotional, mental, spiritual disease, but what I felt was the physical, because I didn't really have time for much of an emotional life either. I was literally trying to put clothes on our back and feed us. And, you know, maybe teach my kid sister to read in the meantime. And yeah, I was trying to protect us to the best I could, and that wasn't very well. So when I got here and I heard about the spiritual part of the disease, I thought that was when I cussed my mom. Because where I'm from, like, you really don't cuss your mom. And one time I got really drunk, came home and cussed my mom. I didn't realize that, you know, she probably could use a cussing. But I don't think that's what it's about today. What I think it's about today is kind of taking responsibility for my actions. I got myself into music school in Boston because I had a few talents other than my profession. And I moved up to Boston in this big truck full of cocaine. And I would practice. My mother didn't really understand moving vans, so she got this big truck, and we wrecked that thing up and down Arkansas to Boston, like bouncing it against the, because we were all wasted. And I'd be playing in the back, and we'd be having wrecks in the front. It was a mess. But I got to school and sat down in the orientation, and it wasn't over before someone asked me if I knew where to get drugs. Like, you could just see it on one of us. I still drank every day in college. There were two people who were constantly going back and forth to the emergency room. There was Shannon, who was suicidal, and me, who was a drunk. And we went back and forth to Beth Israel, really on the regular. And when we weren't going back and forth to Beth Israel, we were, like, licking vodka off the floor. I mean, it was that was my experience. I found that the progression made me less good at making money, that I couldn't really, and so by the end of it, I was picking up pennies off the sidewalk. I really couldn't take care of myself anymore. I was pretty sick. And I had no intention of getting sober. I didn't really know what AA was. I didn't grow up with anyone who was sober. I had a set of grandparents who I think got sober. And they must have been in meetings because after they died, there was an AA coin on one of the spare keys for their town car. But they were mean, and they stayed sober through the church. And the meanest people I've ever known. They were awful to me when I was a small child. So, but I didn't know they were in AA, that they had been to AA. I didn't understand that at all. I was in Boston. I was having some physical trouble. I was 21 years old. And what happened is that I just had a few drinks. I was staying in dorms that were locked, but I was sort of squatting in there, and I was having a few drinks on what I considered my roof deck, which was just the roof. And it was time to go in, and I walked the wrong way, and I walked off the roof, and it was three stories up. And so I cracked my head open pretty badly and, like, bled through the mattress I was on and through the towels and got up the next day and tried to go to work, you know. I mean, I had a moment of clarity that night because I wasn't sure I was hurt because it, you know, I figured something was wrong. And I remember looking at the blood in my hand and thinking, you know, my father is thousands of miles away and I'm still getting hurt. And, but I wasn't going to stop drinking. The next day, I happened to have the first therapist appointment in my life. I was in a new relationship with a lovely person, and I wanted to hold on to it. And my last relationship hadn't gone very well. I had ended that relationship sneaking bottles of booze in my coat and running off to this other woman. Now I was with the other woman, booze in the coat, and I wanted that to really work out. So in the intake, I was doing Romney Care at the time, Massachusetts Free Care, and I had in the interview, that in an intake to get the shrink appointment, they asked if I was an alcoholic, and I said yes, because I was. Like, I knew I was. And they asked if I was on a relapse. And I had quit drinking for 9 months. And I just did drugs every day. But I had recently started drinking again. And so I figured that was a relapse. So I said, yes, I am an alcoholic on a relapse. And so I walk into this meeting. You know, I had been, they couldn't sew my head up because it had been an open wound for 8 hours when I got ran to the, emergency room. So I had a big open wound, like C is for cookie right here, and here I am in my intake talking about my relationship, and she's looking at the sheet which says alcoholic on relapse, and she says I cannot see you for therapy because it will not be effective if you are drinking. And she said, we happen to have a detox here, and we'll hold you a bed till the end of the week. So I said, that's just great. I went, but I had still had booze in my in the room where I was squatting, and I bought it, so I was going to drink it. And so that was a Tuesday. Wednesday, I had 2 40s of Budweiser, and my last drink was Thursday, a Colt 45 that I spread across the day an inch at a time, which couldn't keep me from shaking. It was unsatisfying. And then the next day, Friday, last day of the week, I went into detox. And I lied to them about going to meetings for a long time because I saw the steps. And the way I was counting them at the time, I'm not sure how I did it, I thought 8 out of 12 had God in them. I wasn't going to do that. God hates lesbians. I wasn't going to do it. So I didn't really know what meetings were, but I was pretty sure it had to do with the steps, and I wasn't doing it. I had a social worker who suggested that not everyone in meetings works the steps, and that some people just go for social reasons. And what I knew was that the program I was in alone wasn't going to keep me sober. So I had heard about sponsorship. I went to a meeting, Boston Crossroads. I signed my name in the book, which felt good, sort of like the Book of Life, because I still had all those like Christian thoughts. So I felt like this was St. Peter was going to refer to this later, and I got a sponsor who told me that steps are optional, sort of like the cord in a parachute is optional. Like, you are falling, you know, you are going to hit the ground. You have a parachute. You may pull the string or you may not. And that got my attention because I really felt death upon me. You know, I'm very grateful for the gift of desperation that I had seen the road of alcoholism and it was not going to work for me. I always knew I'd die early drinking like my dad did, but I didn't realize until I fell off the roof that I might not have control of how that happened, that it might hurt and it might be ugly. My first year of sobriety, I threw up blood every day. And often it came from other places too. I had some serious physical problems. I slept 2 or 3 hours a night, and I had this big wound. And I hated everyone. I was 21 years old. I was in a band. Everyone felt older than me. A bunch of Yankees didn't understand me at all. Like, not nearly as cool as me. And I just knew that I needed to do what they did, or I was going to drink myself to death. And that worked. Like, that was really all it took. Because I had a home group, people started to care about me, and people started to pay attention to me. So we would take commitments and outgoing speaker commitments. We'd drive all the way to Maine if we had a commitment there. And there was a guy, I remember once my sponsor told me that the driver didn't play Christmas carols because he was afraid it would offend my atheist sensibilities. I love a Christmas carol, but just like knowing that they were trying to take care of me and protect me was really important. And when I had a year, they asked me to chair the beginner's meeting, and that's what I did. I moved down to Memphis, Tennessee for 6 years for a career reason. Back to Memphis, sort of scene of the crime. And I did, there weren't really gay meetings there. I've never really been a member of a gay meeting. But there are lots of gay people around me. And in Memphis, that wasn't true. And they seemed to get my gender stuff better than anybody else. Maybe it was a cultural thing. That I was really touched that my group asked me to be Santa Claus. never mind, a Christmas party might be a violation of traditions. But and the group's name was Traditions. So the group's name was Traditions, and they were known as like a real by-the-book group. But we had a Christmas party with a Santa, and it was me. And just the they would like... Because this is kids. Like, this is poor Southern kids, like, sitting on... Your trans man's knee, like, what do you want for Christmas, Billy? Like, it felt sort of, and we had potlucks, too, for anniversaries there. We would all bring a dish, and people's wives came, which, people's wives, how sexist is that? But it applies to me. People's significant others came, and it made it obvious that it was it's a family disease, which I think sort of they talk about a lot in our books about how it's a family disease, and I see that today. The more I try to apply the principles of the program to my marriage, the more I believe in singleness of purpose. Like, AA works for drinking, and I have to go elsewhere for other problems. And I didn't grow up in a way that prepared me to have a relationship with another person. That's not AA's problem. AA guarantees me a day sober if I take the directions. Does not guarantee me happiness, which has been a tough thing to take. I guess I'm segueing into what it's like today. AA keeps me sober, and it gives me a chance to be alive and see what I can do with those other issues. I'm having trouble this year loving AA the way that I have historically. My best friend stopped coming to meetings because he felt like we didn't, like being a member of AA wasn't consistent with his atheism, and he's drinking, and we're not in touch. A lot of people come to AA and get their family back. That's not been my story. I don't talk to any of my family anymore, because it endangers my sobriety. I don't talk to this guy anymore because it hurts me. I just got back from the Northeast Regional AA Service Assembly in lovely Warwick, Rhode Island. And we talk a lot at these service assemblies. We've talked about it for years, how AA isn't really growing. They think there's something like 18 million drunks in the U.S., and we're at about 1 million. And we've been kind of stagnant for over a decade. And one thing I wasn't really aware of until this assembly a few weeks ago is that Alcoholics Anonymous in 1977, nearly 40 years ago, was 33% women, and now we're 35. So that's roughly no progress in about 40 years. And as much as I love the big book, how long are we going to ask women to just get over it? That it talks about in the first 164 pages, the alcoholic is a man. And there's a chapter, Two Wives, and it's not about women alcoholics. Like, I think we build a temple to our founders really, really well, and I just wonder how many human sacrifices are underneath it. So that's what's been on my mind, is if we're here because we want to save people from the disease of alcoholism, I think it's important that we think about how we're talking to the newcomer. And I know this group thinks about that, which is why part of the reason I'm bringing it up. I talked to my sponsor about this, and she said that she disagrees with me that it's a societal thing that women just don't want to admit that they're alcoholics. But I admitted I was an alcoholic, and even if you don't admit you're an alcoholic, sometimes you end up in here. And I just, I think it's important to think about, you know, if this is our basic text and it's written in the 30s by some guys with 2 or 3 years sober, is that all we're ever going to know about being sober? And you know, how do we speak to the newcomer? I mean, there was a member of my home group, Barry L., who wrote this, I suppose they still call it a pamphlet, called Living Sober, and we use that. And that has really practical suggestions that work for me. I got to tell you, I'm 18 years sober. I do a lot of service. I've seen what the general conference is going to look at this year, the agenda, and it's about freaking footnotes. Like, if you're in a group that saves people's lives and it's not growing for 12 years, like, maybe we need to get some real issues on the agenda. So that's what's on my mind is helping people get sober. And staying sober myself. Like, I think that my love for AA is, one of the most important parts of my life. And in this next phase of my recovery, I think it's important to protect that and think about what I do have to bring to the table and also how I can improve my life outside of AA. I mean, AA is a bridge back to life. I'm not getting off the bridge, but I wanna make sure that I experience life and don't hide myself in my step work, you know, and don't assume that because I've worked solid steps that I've taken care of my problems other than alcoholism, which I think has been an issue for me personally. So I'm incredibly grateful. Thank you for asking me to speak today, and hope you have a good night. Thanks.